And in fact, in part, it goes back to a previous visit to PI, precisely to Lucien Hardy in 2007, where he gave me part of the inspiration that led to this work that I'm talking about today, in fact. Okay, so, as I said, talking about a positive and local formalism for quantum theory, what's that supposed to mean? Okay, let me give you a little overview. So the standard formulation of quantum theory, by that I mean, you have a Hilbert space whose elements are the states of your system, and then you have observables represented as operators on the Hilbert space and so on. So that's what I refer to as a standard formulation. So this has some serious limitations, especially from a, let's say, general relativistic perspective, and I'll outline some of them. And then as a kind of response to that, I present a review of the general boundary formulation in its what I call now the amplitude formalism, the formalism that I've used for that since the beginning. Then I'm going to switch to the new stuff, which is a different formalism that I call the positive formalism for that, which has some interesting advantages. And finally, it's probably the shortest but maybe most interesting part of my talk to some extent, this naturally gives rise to certain questions and directions one should look in, and I'll comment on these at the end. Okay. And by the way, is there some pointer or something?
Just the usual.
Oh, yeah, right. I don't remember. Okay. to think about the standard formulation and clarify its ingredients, it's useful to switch back first to classical physics and just very briefly review the concept of measurement in classical physics. So this is supposed to be a space-time diagram. While in classical physics, from a conceptual point of view, this is all very simple. Basically, a system is determined by some dynamical law, and a state, I mean a system as you encountered in nature, say, let's call the space of these states L. Then we have observables, which are usually thought of as maps from the state space to the real numbers, which give us information about the state. So here, measurements just yield objective information about the state. The state, as I'm trying to kind of indicate by this uniform color here, is really a global object. It lives in space-time, in a sense. It's just the state of the system, or the global solution, if you want, of the classical equations of motion. And then it's often useful to bring that into correspondence with initial data on a hypersurface, which one usually takes to be equal time hypersurface, or maybe a space-like hypersurface. Okay, so that's very simple. Now, in quantum theory, it's different. Although the standard formulation of quantum theory is modeled on this classical picture to some extent, it differs in crucial aspects. And the most important being that a measurement modifies the state. Okay? So now, if we think of that in space-time terms, we have some initial state psi 1, we make a measurement, we have a so-called collapse of the wave function and leading to a state psi 2, and The observer is the vehicle, if you want, here that for expressing this measurement, and it's mathematically implemented as an operator on what, again, we call the state space, but which is now a Hilbert space. Okay. So there's a very important difference to the previous picture that I tried to indicate with these colors, which is precisely the fact that measurements change the state. So that means that states are still global in space, but they're local in time. Okay. So the measurement changes the state in time. So already here, you can see that time plays an important role, right? So let's now think about consecutive measurements. So again, we have a step, say, one. We make a measurement encoded in an observable of one, leading to another state, and another measurement encoded in another observable of two. And here, looking at the mathematical structures of the objects in play here, the operator product between these operators encodes a joint measurement of these two observables, a particular kind of joint measurement. And what I want to emphasize here is that the order that appears in this product here is the temporal order of the measurements, right? So for example, I mean, well, non-commutativity of quantum observables, for example, the canonical commutation relations, has to do precisely with this, has to do with the fact that if you do different temporal ordering of measurements, you get different results. And again, of course, precisely because the measurements modify the state. So again, this shows that time plays a very special role here. So now, suppose we have no notion of time given to us a priori, okay? So in particular, if you want to do quantum gravity, for example, as a lot here at this institute want to do or are interested in, then, well, you don't have a priori anything on your coordinate system here. In general relativity, the distinction between space and time rises dynamically, and it's not an a priori given thing. So what do we do? I mean, if we suppose that this is like time and this is like space, we're led to a picture like this, where these blobs are supposed to represent observables and measurements, with a state here, state here, state here, or we can slice it in a completely different way, and that would give a completely different picture. So which is it? So, well, so there's a big problem, obviously, here. Okay, so how can we address this? So first, let's take a closer look at this standard formalism that I've been using. So again, that's the picture with the two measurements here. And here I try to represent kind of the mathematical objects that are associated with the space-time diagram, in a sense. So again, we have two observables. And so the observables, well, are operators, of course. So they are mapped from the Hilbert space to the Hilbert space. Here, this U represents the unitary evolution here. In fact, on previous pages, I've implicitly assumed the Heisenberg picture, where I just said there's a state. And here, I want to explicitly write the evolution of the state. But that's just a detail, how you prefer to do things. And then here again, there's an observable that goes from the Hilbert space to the Hilbert space. So really, we have a chain of operators here that are composed, really. But instead of, so a small technical digression, instead of thinking as the operators as maps from H to H, we can also think of them as maps from H star, tensor H, to C. So if you want, we are really thinking of them in terms of their matrix elements. That's all. Nothing surprising here, okay? And then the composition of operators can, of course, I can write them down in terms of matrix elements. So the thing is that if I have two operators written as matrix elements and I want to compose them, then this, of course, done by inserting a complete orthonormal basis, right? That's standard. keeping in, with this point of view, we can slightly rewrite this stuff on the left here. So that suggests, in fact, the diagrams already suggest that we should think of both the time evolution, which was here represented by this operator U, and the observables, operators O1, O2, as localized in space-time regions. Okay? Of course, these space-time regions essentially are time intervals, usually. And in fact, these time intervals here are usually thought of to be have length zero, right? They're instantaneous, usually, in the usual point of view. And okay, so now that we think of these objects as associated to space-time regions, we can do the following. We can associate the Hilbert space or its dual to each equal time hypersurface in this diagram. Okay, so these are the black lines here. depending on the orientation. Okay, so if it's oriented like this, we put a H. If it's oriented like this, H star. So orientation here is with respect to the interior of the region. Okay? So here again we would have on here we would have H star and here H with respect to this region. Here also H and H star. Okay? So now the boundary of each region is, of course, composed of disjoint union of two hypersurfaces. And we can associate with this boundary as a whole the tensor product of the Hilbert spaces for the individual hypersurfaces. Okay? So at the moment, that's just some technical comments I'm making here. And at the same time, remember that we want to think of these operators as maps from this space to the complex numbers. So from the space-time perspective, that means now that these are maps from the boundary Hilbert space, which is this thing, to the complex numbers. Okay. So all this is really a preparation for the general boundary formulation. So in the general boundary formulation, we do that, but in a more general way. Okay. So now we think of general space-time regions, we do the following. So for each hypersurface in space-time, we associate a Hilbert space, and for each region, we associate an amplitude map from the boundary Hilbert space to the complex numbers. So this amplitude, so for example here, this M2, or also this M1, so this is essentially the same object that, or the object that generalizes what on the previous slide was called U. Okay, was the time evolution where nothing happened. Here, it's like precisely like this region where we just have a free evolution in time of the system. Okay. So that's like this here. And this is where, instead of calling this U, we call this rho now, okay? It's the change of notation. And for each region that contains an observable, like this one here, we associate what we call an observable map, which is also a map from the boundary Hilbert space to C, precisely generalizing what we had here, right? I mean, as I said, these O1 and O2 really maps from this space to the complex numbers. And this space is the one associated to the boundary, in fact, in this case of each of these regions. Okay. by the way, if you want to ask a question, I invite you to do it right away, because I don't want to just go too fast and then something gets lost.
So I think there's something I'm misunderstanding. When you say that the observable is a map from H star tensor H to the complex,
right?
I'm thinking, okay, it's a map to the reals and the reals are part of the complex. Like I'm thinking of it as, you know, if I take the trace of this observable with, you know, the state, then I get a real number. But is
right.
that the map you're thinking of?
Yes, exactly. So okay, so that's a thing.
So then
that
my question would be, why can I think of the unitaries as a map to the complex numbers? As I would normally describe it as a map from H star tensor H to H star tensor H again.
So here this is if you insert what you do, you insert basically an initial state, a final state, and what the map gives you is the transition amplitude.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. So that's maybe that wasn't clear. And I'll come back to that in a later slide also. But
so how would you think of the H and the H star in the context of an observable, one of the regions that has an observable? Should I again think of the H as the input state,
yes,
and the
exactly.
H star as the what you're measuring?
Yes.
The basis element that you're measuring.
Right. So okay. So here, of course, I mean, usually we think of this in space-time terms as the same time, the initial and the final here. So we think of it just as an operator that we apply when we measure, right, at this time. It's just I mean, for, in some sense, convenience of the drawing and also to motivate what I'm going to do, that I draw this here in a slightly extended way. If you want, you can think of this as extended, and then it's really a composition of an observable with a small time evolution of this type. So. Okay, so the generalization we do is this one here, as I said. So we allow much more general regions of space-time, again associating Hilbert spaces to the boundaries, and then these amplitude maps to the region that generalize the unitary evolution, and these observable maps to regions that contain observables which generalize the observables we saw before, and possibly include also some kind of time evolution to justify their space-time extent, if you want. So, but you can also always kind of squeeze that region to be infinitely thin to get back to a notion of observable that's really kind of infinitesimal. So, one thing you might notice is that I didn't write space and time here because I don't have to, in fact, right? I mean, if I turn this, if I rotate this picture, it looks the same, okay? So at least from a point of view of the mathematical formalism, there's no space and time anymore, although I have to talk about that, about the interpretation of this. I'll do that in a moment. So, mathematically speaking, this is what I'm led to is basically a version of topological quantum field theory. Okay. Just to avoid a misunderstanding that arises sometimes, so even this is called topological quantum field theory. This is not about quantum field theory that arises from a classical topological theory. Okay. It's a mathematical framework that might encompass all kinds of theories, physical or not, and in fact was mostly used and is mostly used to define knot invariants and invariants of manifolds and do topology and stuff like that. Okay, so So we have all these Hilbert spaces associated to hypersurfaces and all these amplitude maps and so on. So we have lots of structure, much more than before. I mean, the standard formulation with one Hilbert space, one algebra of observables on it. So we have all the structure, and we have to somehow make this all consistent with each other. And for this, we have a bunch of axioms, which again come precisely from here. Okay. So for example, if we take a hypersurface and invert its orientation, then basically we get the dual Hilbert space. In fact, we have seen that already, right? I mean, that's what I did already previously when I was telling you here that you should put H or H star depending on the orientation. Right? So we did that already. The decomposition rule, if you have a hypersurface that's a disjoint union of two hypersurfaces, then the associated Hilbert space is the tensor product. Okay. This also we did already here, or I told you that that's what you should do, right? Associate this tensor product with the total boundary here. And then the most important rule in some sense is the gluing rule. So if we have two adjacent regions, we can glue them together and relate the amplitude for the joint region to the amplitudes for the individual regions with this relatively simple rule. And in fact, if you look closely at this, you discover that that's essentially the same formula that I wrote on the previous slide here, right? It's the same formula, except with a slightly different point of view. But so this basis is here inserted precisely on the hypersurface where you glue the two regions together, right? Yeah.
So if sigma 1 and sigma 2 aren't sort of disjoint but meet along a common boundary, are there some conditions that you have to specify on that boundary? So I'm thinking, like, if you have metric data, for example, you can't just glue two manifolds together if the
right.
boundaries don't have the same metric.
That's right. Yeah. So, for example, in this example, if they carry a metric, say, these manifolds, then this gluing will only be possible precisely when these metrics match. Okay. Another way to think about is to think about it the other way around, to think that you have the joint region and you split it up. Okay, then it always makes sense. If you think of it as gluing, then you have data to match. So maybe at this point, that's one remark I should make here, that in this framework here, these manifolds have to be topological manifolds, at least for these operations to make sense, but they don't need to have any further structure. But they might have further structure depending on the quantum theory that you actually want to model, right? So, another question or remark?
Wading in on the same question. I thought the implication might have been that the tensor product of the Hilbert spaces is too big because you're allowing wave function discontinuity.
You mean
so
here?
Discontinu-
you mean in this?
Yes.
No. So, so there's one remark I wanted to make later, but so here I'm talking about a disjoint union, and that's important.
Disjoint meaning that topologically disjoint? Separate.
Yes.
So it's not just like the interval 0, 1, including 1, and the interval 1, 2, not including 1. In other words, you can't split up, say, a single Cauchy surface into two subs. Or are you
no, because these manifolds.
These should be different boundary components of the manifolds. In other words.
Yes. So your example with the Cauchy hypersurface, indeed, you cannot split it up in that way because when you split it up, this sense of decomposition, the boundary of your hypersurface that you get or of the piece is part of the hypersurface. So in that case, it wouldn't be a disjoint union because this boundary is contained on both sides. And that's why it doesn't work in this case. There's a generalization of this to also include unions that are not disjoint. And in fact, in that case, it's not necessarily the simple tensor product, but something else. But Yeah, I really don't have time to talk about this today.
Yeah. But, in your picture, though, it looked like there was a sort of triple point where it's
free. Yes, yes, of course. I admit that in my pictures, in fact, the way I drew this picture, for example, that's in fact why I emphasize these points here, because to distinguish these different hypersurfaces here. And in fact, in these pictures, if you take them literally, precisely that happens. So it's just that the picture where this happens is simpler than the picture where it doesn't happen. well, I could have drawn like tubes or something that, but and in fact, it's an important point that maybe I'll come back to at the very end. Yeah. Okay.
Just a question for clarification. Sigma 1 and sigma 2, I take to be the boundaries of these regions.
Here.
Excluding for the yellow region, excluding the right hand.
Exactly.
Boundary.
Yeah.
But then you've defined sigma up top to be the union of sigma 1 and sigma 2. And yet in your diagram, it looks like sigma is the name you give to the line that connects them.
The notation here is not the same as here. I'm sorry about
that.
Okay,
so the boundary that connects them, let's call that sigma prime.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm sorry. So these three things are separate axioms, and in each axiom, what is called sigma or sigma one or whatever isn't necessarily the same as in another one.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Maybe I should have named them so that that would be avoided, but okay. But again, this gluing rule, as I told you already, is really this thing in disguise, right? And that's where it comes from, or that's what it specializes to if you take this picture here literally.
Guys, in your motivating example, there's some places H and some places H star or something, the dual space.
Yes.
But here you don't orient the boundaries in some way so that there's.
You mean here?
When you say whether it's a final boundary or an initial boundary, you're not giving that information.
Yeah. So here, the orientation. Okay, so I'm supposing that my regions have orientations.
So
I didn't say that, but I'm supposing
okay.
that. And then in these pictures, it's always the case that the boundaries carry the induced orientations. And also, I'm requiring that if I glue them together, that the orientations here and here match up. Okay, so yeah. Sorry, I didn't make this explicit. Okay. So far, this is basically just a mathematical formalism, and it's not clear that this has to do anything with quantum theory, right? I mean, quantum theory is not just all these objects, it's not just the Hilbert space and the observables, it's also the rules how to extract from those objects things you can measure, right? I mean, it's probability interpretation, expectation values, and so on. So that's what I'm going to tell you now. So probabilities. I'm claiming that you can, if you have a space-time region and you have this object, which is the amplitude for that region, then you can talk about probabilities for measurements in that region as follows. So, I mean, notice that probabilities in quantum theory are always conditional probabilities. I mean, usually, for example, you say, well, I have prepared this initial state, and now I check if my final state is that one, right? And then, of course, you're checking if the final state is present conditional on having prepared this other initial state, right? So here, also probabilities are of this conditional nature, unsurprisingly, but the way to encode these two ingredients, namely one being the preparation or, let's say, knowledge in advance that you have about the measurement or system, and on the other hand, the observation that you make or the question that you're posing are encoded as subspaces of your boundary Hilbert space, okay? Closed subspaces, in fact. And the probability, let me phrase this like this, that the physics in your region is described by A, the subspace, given that it is described by S, is this formula, okay? I mean, that looks like a complicated formula, kind of. So again, here, as in previous formulas, appears a sum over a complete orthonormal basis of your boundary Hilbert space. Okay, so here, so this row is the amplitude map, this also, and this PA and PS are the orthogonal projectors onto your subspaces. Okay, in fact, yeah, maybe I should have. I wrote the formula here in a different way than I usually do it, and in a way that looks, in fact, more complicated. But I did this for a good reason that you shall see later. Maybe, okay, so, okay, let me tell you the following. So since this is an orthogonal projector, this expression is zero if this state is projected out by this projector, okay? So in particular, you can choose an orthonormal basis that's adapted to your projector, and then you see that this expression is equivalent to taking rho m of PA of psi A modulus squared. Okay, so that's what I could have written instead of this product here. Okay, yeah. Sorry, maybe I should have, I really should have written this other formula too. So it's basically just. Okay, so this would be the numerator. Okay, so this is equivalent to what I brought. Okay, if you think about it a little, then you see that it's equivalent. And for the denominator, the same, except that we have this other projector here. Okay. Well, I'll tell you soon the reason why I wrote it in this apparently more complicated form. okay, but first, first, I want to tell you how this recovers the usual transition probabilities that, as we know them. Okay. okay. So let's take a space-time region that's in accordance with the first pictures that we saw of the standard formulation. So our region is a time interval, times all of space, and its boundary has two components that I call here sigma 1 and sigma 2. And here I've also indicated the orientation. So if I take this oriented to the past, then I call it sigma 1, and I call this sigma 2. And this oriented to the future, I call it sigma 2 bar. I mean, it's the opposite oriented to that one, right? So here, in this notation, sigma 1 and sigma 2 are equally oriented if you think of this as an orientation coming from a global time direction. So the boundary state space is the tensor product of this one with this one, right? We take the orientation induced from the region. So here and here, they are opposite, right? And right, and then we have the rule that this space on the oppositely oriented hypersurface is the dual, okay? So as before, we identify all these Hilbert spaces with for equal time hypersurface of the same orientation. I mean, I'm saying as before because that's what we implicitly did here, right? This was H, this was H, this was H, this was H star, this was H star, this was H star, okay? So it's exactly just that. We're just kind of recovering this picture here, or a piece of that picture. And then, so as I told you, this row thing really encodes what I call U, and here is the exact formula in which sense it does that, okay, applicable to this picture here. So U is now the unitary time evolution operator from time t1 to time t2, right? And now, so if I think about this in terms of the general boundary formulation, so how do I get the usual transition probability out of that? With that, I mean, I prepare some initial state psi 1 here, and I'm testing for some final state psi 2 there, right? So the way to do that is the following, or one way to do that is the following. This subspace S that describes the preparation is the following, is this tensor product. So remember that my boundary Hilbert space is this tensor product, right? So it's a tensor product where of all the states, which can be written in such a way that we have psi 1 here and something else here, something arbitrary here in the second component. So that defines a subspace, okay? Now, for the measurement, I'm doing something very similar. For the question I'm asking, I'm doing very something very similar, except that I leave open now what is my initial state and just specify the final one. And that, again, is a subspace of this tensor product. Now, if I take these two subspaces, take the associated projectors, and plug them into this formula, then that's exactly what comes out. So we're getting back exactly the correct transition amplitude. Okay. So, well, okay. okay, now let's go to observables. so we consider a space-time region that carries an observable. And the associated observable map allows us to extract expectation values for measurements of this observable in M in the following way. So again, we need two ingredients. As usual with expectation values for observables, we have on the one hand the observable and on the other hand the state in which we evaluate the expectation value. So it's no different here. We have the observable and we have the state, but instead of a state, this is now again, as for transition amplitudes or amplitudes, this again is subspace of the boundary Hilbert space. In fact, I'm sorry, this should be HDM, not H sigma. But, and then we have a formula for the expectation value that looks almost identical to the previous formula. Remember this formula here. So the difference now is that here we have the same projector, and that this is not the amplitude map, but this is the observable map that has in it the observable, if you want. In fact, I think there's one formula missing. That yeah, I'm sorry about that. The formula that's analogous to this one here. So basically, in the case of the observable, this formula where this is now the observable map looks essentially the same, but with this being the observable operator here. But, well, okay. Sorry, I forgot this formula. Ah, no, here it is. Oh, yeah. No, okay, so, sorry. No, I do have it. This is the general expression, but to recover the usual case of an observable, okay, here again is the picture of an observable in space-time, and here I've tried to, in fact, clarify the fact that usually we think of this observable as applied as just one fixed time and not in a time interval, okay? And then this is very similar to what we saw before, except that now it's a kind of infinitesimal time interval, if you want, but nothing stops us from doing that. And then this relates the observable map and the standard operator. And then the subspace S in the previous case is the following, as we put the state psi in the first component here and leave the second component open. And plugging that into the formula yields precisely the correct output. Okay. So we recover both standard transition amplitudes and standard expectation values in this framework. But if you look at these formulas and the text, there's no mention anywhere of time or anything like that, okay? So, okay. Well, maybe I skipped this remark because, okay, maybe I just say one sentence about this. So what I've shown you so far is the amplitude formalism of the GBF, but only for bosonic degrees of freedom. In case of fermionic degrees of freedom, things get a little more complicated and you don't have Hilbert spaces, but you have Kind spaces, which are indefinite inner product spaces. But I'll continue in the simpler, purely bosonic case. Okay. If you have questions about this at the very end, I can maybe tell you more. Okay, so here these are just some applications of the general boundary formulation in the amplitude formalism. So this, just to show you, this is not an empty theoretical construct, but really has already a number of interesting applications. Of course, the first point here is just emphasizing again that if you restrict this to space-time pictures and to regions and boundaries of this type, then you just recover the standard formulation of quantum theory. And there are a number of other applications that are outside the reach of the standard formulation of quantum theory. Okay, but again, maybe I shouldn't comment on that too much. because now I want to criticize, in some sense, what I've done so far here. And take a hard look at it from an, like, let's say, operationalist point of view, okay? Of course, the operationally most relevant part of this all is precisely the extraction of probabilities of expectation values. So these are the things where we get really in contact with measurable physics. So if we look closely, in particular, at the formulas that do that, we notice the following. So one thing is that the relevant objects on the boundaries of regions that enter are not states or elements of the boundary Hilbert space, but are really subspaces or equivalently projection operators. Okay, right? I mean, just going back to the formulas. I mean, the xi's here are right, just a kind of mathematical device, but the really important objects that enter here are the projectors, right? I mean, that determine and that correspond in some sense to the physical conditions of the measurement, or equally in this formula. So we should really bring those objects to the forefront of our formalism. Another thing is that the formulas for probabilities and expectation values look somewhat complicated and unnatural. But they suggest a common element, and that's in part why I've written them in the way I wrote them, namely like this, and the other formula in a very, very similar way. Okay, so how can we exploit these observations in a productive manner? So the first thing is that on the hypersurfaces, taking serious the fact that the important elements, the important objects on the hypersurface are not the states or elements of our Hilbert spaces, but are projection operators, what we should do is, well, we should take the space of these objects, or a space that naturally contains these objects. So we are led to, in fact, consider, instead of the Hilbert space, the algebra of operators itself on the Hilbert space, okay? Because that contains the projection operators in particular. So now, concerning the probability map, sorry, the amplitude map, if we look at the formulas, we see that a structure like this is a common element in these two formulas that I showed you, okay? Where the sigma would be a projection operator, okay? So this suggests strongly to precisely define this object as an object in its own right. And it's, in fact, it's a map from this operator space to the complex numbers. And that's also why I didn't write it in this way, okay? Because this is not linear in this operator here. This is linear in the operator, okay? So it's just a linear map. We can do something similar for observables by just replacing this amplitude map by the corresponding observable map, okay? And I call these here expectation maps, although that name maybe isn't so nice, but anyway. So if we define these objects, how do things look like? Well, the two formulas that are so important simplify considerably, right? I mean, the probability is just a quotient of two evaluations of this probability map with the two different projectors that are defined precisely by these subspaces here. And the expectation value of an observable, again, is a quotient of this type, right? Except that here I have the amplitude map, the probability map now, and here I have this expectation map. So this looks much simpler than in the amplitude formalism, right? But is it just nice new formulas, or is there more behind? Well, there's much more behind. In fact, this is really much more natural. Why? Okay. And here come realness and positivity into the play. So if we consider the subset of these operators that are self-adjoined, this is a real vector space as a subspace of this. And in fact, the original operator space can be seen as the complexification of this real vector space. Okay. Furthermore, if we look at the positive operators, they form a subset of this set of self-adjoint operators. And in fact, in technical terms, they form a generating proper cone in this real vector space. And the important thing is that this makes this vector space into an ordered vector space. Okay, that means that it carries a partial order. Okay, and for example, if we look at these projection operators that are so important, then they have an ordering precisely if and only if the corresponding subspaces are inclusions. Okay. And in fact, the projection operators in technical terms again form a lattice in this ordered vector space. Okay. And in fact, these ideas from like quantum foundation's point of view are not so new. I mean, if you think about the quantum logic, then this kind of structures are very much at the foreground of what you're looking at. Okay. Furthermore, the probability map is positive. That means that if I evaluate it on a self-adjoint operator, it's real. And if I evaluate it on a positive operator, it's positive. Okay. And now, if you just look at this slide and forget my previous formula for probabilities and just take into account this one, then these properties, together with this formula, automatically already imply that probabilities are positive and smaller or equal to 1. Okay? The smaller or equal to 1 has to do with the fact that this is a subspace of this one. And so this PA is smaller than PS, smaller or equal than PS. And that means in the quotient that the numerator is smaller or equal than the denominator, which translates into this being smaller or equal to 1. Okay. So far I've motivated this by using this the amplitude formalism, the Hilbert spaces, the amplitude maps, and so on, and use them to construct these new objects, these operator spaces and these probability maps and so on. But what we've just seen before on the previous slide motivates us to consider these new objects as objects in their own right that not necessarily arise from Hilbert spaces, from amplitude maps, and so on. And in fact, it turns out that these structures satisfy axioms that look, again, very similar to the original axioms satisfied by these structures here. Okay? I'll not list them now, but... okay. So as I already mentioned also on the previous slide, positivity and the normalization of probabilities now derive directly from the positivity of the probability map. And in fact, we might restrict this whole formalism just to these self-adjoint operators, to these real vector spaces, real-ordered vector spaces. Okay, now a slightly technical remark from a TQFT perspective. That means that we are going from an oriented formalism to an unoriented formalism, because it turns out that these changes that happen when you change the orientation are identities on this space. Okay, so in a sense, so I told you already that the space of operators is a complexification of this, and in fact the orientation change is something like a complex conjugation and leaves precisely this subspace invariant. But okay, that's... okay, another thing is that now we have more freedom due to these larger spaces, and instead of just considering observable maps, we can consider maps that implement more general quantum operations. Okay, so I'll just call them operation maps to mark this change. So in space-time, things look like this, very similar to the previous picture, except that now the objects associated here are the new objects. Okay. Okay. So let's make a summary of this, a first summary, let's say. okay. So this positive formalism is intriguing for a number of reasons. So the first two are basically inherited from the GBF and the amplitude formalism, namely the space-time locality and metric background independence is of course inherited from the fact that we're working in the GBF. And also, it has a wide applicability, which is, again, just inherited from the amplitude formalism. Because if I have a theory given in terms of the amplitude formalism, I can convert it to a theory in terms of the positive formalism in the way that I just showed you. Right? I go from Hilbert spaces to operator spaces, and so on, and so on. And then, by the way, maybe I should make that clear. If the original theory in the amplitude formalism satisfies the axioms, the new theory... the same theory formulated in the positive formalism will also satisfy automatically the corresponding axioms. Okay. Okay, so another reason is the operationalism with a simple and elegant way to predict probabilities and expectation values, which at least I think is much more compelling than the previous formulas. Its amenability to quantum information theory, right? That I'll come back to that in a further slide. So at the same time, so this is basically the state where I am, and that raises immediately various questions. So the last part of my talk is just five questions, one slide each, about what this may or may not suggest. Okay, so the first thing, no states, no collapse, but what? So this is not strictly speaking something new of the positive formalism, but it becomes clearer in the positive formalism. Namely that the traditional concept of state as a specification, if you want, of the reality of a system is untenable in the GBF. Okay? With that, I mean that there's not necessarily any hypersurfaces or things where you have a Hilbert space and you can say the elements of this Hilbert space are states of my system in the traditional sense. Okay. And so from this point of view, one could say that this also kills collapse interpretations of quantum theory and any model of the collapse as a physical event. Okay. Of course, I'm supposing that the GBF is true in a sense, okay, and which, well, I'll come back to that later maybe. Okay, so instead, I mean, looking at the probability interpretation, the relevant mathematical objects entering the probability interpretation are the elements of this space D plus, which we thought originally of as the space of positive operators. So we call them here just to give them a name, quantum boundary conditions, which are sufficiently generic to encompass all kinds of interpretations. And only the atomic elements, if you want, namely the one-dimensional projectors, correspond to elements in the Hilbert space, supposing that this arises as operators. And even then, these coincide only in special circumstances with the traditional notion of quantum state, right? Only if we have a hypersurface, we have a background metric, a space like hypersurfaces, and look at the Hilbert space associated to that. And there we can make this connection. In general, we cannot. Okay, so but of course the question now is, can we say anything more about the physical interpretation of these elements of this space? Do only special elements of the space have a physical interpretation? For example, only the projectors, or do other elements also have a physical interpretation? Okay, so it's kind of the big questions here. So somewhat related to that, but more going to the mathematical side, is the structure of ordered vector spaces sufficient? Or do we need more structure, for example, a Jordan product or even the full operator product? Then what is the right size and topology for these spaces? So in this talk, I've essentially assumed that these contain all bounded operators. In my Christmas paper, I've assumed that these are only Hilbert-Schmidt operators for some reasons that you can read there. a related remark, somewhat related, is, maybe I should skip this small remark. It's not so important. Okay, another aspect of this is related to the operational kind of philosophy behind this, or operationalist philosophy, I should say. So the transition from Hilbert spaces to these spaces of quantum boundary condition gets rid of some operationally irrelevant information, which is in mostly phases. And what is more, the structural requirements on these new spaces are weaker than those coming from the Hilbert space. So in particular, I've just assumed these to be ordered vector spaces, but maybe you need more structures. But at least it seems that you need less than the full operator algebra structure. So this gives us new freedom in the construction of quantum theories. And in fact, this slide is basically the main reason why I pushed this approach recently. In particular, I hope that this helps to solve the state locality problem in quantum field theory, which is, Raphael left already. It was related to his question in some sense. Maybe later I can have questions. Okay, so quantum information theory. Well, as I mentioned already, this opens the general boundary formulation to quantum information theory. Because in particular, if you take the positive formalism and you go back to the standard to the space-time pictures of the standard formulation with time intervals, you basically recover the mixed state formalism of the standard formulation. So this means in particular that you can now apply arbitrary, implement arbitrary quantum operations. As wild speculation here, if this maybe even can help us work towards a generativistic and quantum framework for statistical physics and thermodynamics. Okay, so last but not least, the circle closes here, so we are coming back to Lucy and Hardy in a sense. So if you look at this space-time picture in this positive formalism, and supposing we have three regions with quantum operations in them, then the composition of these regions, the gluing, remember, is done by inserting complete bases of the intermediate boundary Hilbert spaces, right? So if we symbolize this here on the right hand by lines that connect these, then what we get is basically something like an operator tensor network, as Lucien would call it, probably. So remember that this issue with this inserting of an orthonormal basis can equivalently be viewed as a composition of operators. Okay, so you can think of these arrows also as some kind of composition of operators. And the spaces that are relevant here, where these lines live, are precisely these things that you can think of as spaces of operators, or more generally, quantum boundary conditions. And in the nodes, what you have as a mathematical structure are these operation maps, okay, that are kind of operator tensors, if you want. So the question is, I mean, that looks very similar to Lucien's proposal for formulation. But the question is, what is the exact relation really with Lucien's approach? And that I would very much like to understand better. And in particular, one issue here that arises is that, so this formulation is completely atemporal, right? I mean, we don't need to know anything about time or space concretely to make sense of this. Whereas this here is also has a certain independence of a space-time background structure, but it is not time symmetric. So it does have a certain notion of time here. I mean, at least in Lucien's formulation. I mean, here this picture probably not, because that just mathematical, I mean, a representation of the mathematics that's going on here. Okay, so with this, I would like to end my talk. Thank you.
Questions? So having gone from sort of a pure state formalism to this mixed state formalism, is it possible that you could talk about sort of more general von Neumann algebras where you don't necessarily have a, which aren't necessarily the algebra of operators on some Hilbert space. And
yes.
You don't have pure states, but you still have this notion of mixed states.
Yes.
And have you done any work?
Right. No, I haven't. So that's really, I mean, very new. I mean, it's the Christmas paper because it came out on Christmas Eve last year. so I haven't really done anything more than that, than what I've shown you. And but I would expect that you could do that.
Is there some indications? I mean, the algebraic quantum field theory literature is full of type 3, type 2
yes.
Von Neumann algebras. So it seems like this might be an interesting direction.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah.
In the question more on the formalism and the general boundary, in a quantum field theory, generally you have entanglement at space-like separations for quantum fields. So how is this coded in the general boundary where you are considering regions?
So this has to do, in fact, with this issue of gluing hypersurfaces that have boundaries themselves. So if you just use the usual Hilbert space formalism, then you cannot take, let's say, the Hilbert space of a free boson, a free bosonic field theory in space-time, and split it into two pieces corresponding, let's say, to a half plane or a half space and another half space in such a way that this is a tensor product of Hilbert spaces. Here, what I'm hoping is that precisely, in fact, this related to this point here, that's precisely the problem you're describing in some sense, that the freedom this gives you, namely that these spaces are not necessarily coming from Hilbert spaces, and that they carry less structure, that this would help you to solve this problem. So, I mean, okay, just more specifically about the entanglement as such, in fact, isn't a problem. I mean, that you would even have if you could split this Hilbert space that was described in a tensor product, right? And then it's just an entanglement, and that's completely compatible with everything I showed. In fact, the problem I was talking about is deeper in some sense than that. But
So if I've understood correctly, the axioms of your positive formalism provide for a framework allowing for theories much more exotic than usual quantum theory.
Well, not much more. I mean, the point is that, of course, I still have the probability interpretation, I mean, this probability interpretation and notions of expectation values. And I still, of course, need a more concrete connection of these, projection operators or whatever they are with actual experimental circumstances, right? So I have more freedom, but it's not exactly clear to me how much more freedom you have.
So that's really interesting. But suppose you wanted to go back and recover the usual Hilbert space formalism. Have you thought of that? If you could add additional axioms to recover that standard formalism?
That's an interesting question. So that's, that depends, of course, on what exactly are the structures you're imposing here. So if you just have ordered vector spaces, then you would have to add considerable structure, I think. Not sure how much. If you are in the maximum case, that these are, let's say for Norman algebras, in that case you can always reconstruct a Hilbert space, but you still could have problems with these faces. Okay, so even in that case, when you put kind of as much structure as possible to make it as close to the original formalism, there's a little bit of structure that you have to reconstruct or that you have to put in a coherent way to get back to Hilbert spaces that match up nicely. But I mean, it's an interesting question how much structure you actually have to add and how that would work depending on what you have here. That's
Can you do this on more general background spaces, so not only Minkowski, but for example the lattice,
or some yes, you can also do that on the lattice.
And then you could probably remain finite dimensional even.
Yes, yes. Yeah, you're thinking about lattice models where you have degrees of freedoms in each lattice site that are finite dimensional, and then you glue together the pieces to form a lattice. Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
One of the things that crops up in the operator tensor framework that doesn't seem to have cropped up here yet is that it's quite typical that when you try to predict the probability associated with some sort of fragment of the circuit, in fact, that probability isn't well defined. And so you need to have first of all, a condition that tells you whether or not it makes sense to try and write down a probability. And then if it does, an expression for that probability. Whereas you just seem to have straight off an expression for the probability without having to herald that the probability is yeah, so in this case, for example, were it the case that there were some wires on the right hand side in the circuit, imagine there were some wires coming out the bottom.
Right. Yeah.
And then you could send information in, so it's only if
right.
you have control over it.
Yes.
And likewise, in your picture, it's only if you have control over what comes in the
yeah,
bottom,
exactly.
for example.
Yeah. I mean, that's something I didn't say, but that, as you observe, is implicit here. I didn't know how to represent it nicely, and I didn't have time to really say it. So of course, for a correspondence to exist like this, where these, let's say, operator tensors only talk to these other ones, the underlying assumption here is that, physically speaking, there's no information going through these boundaries. So that's a condition on these operations, of course. Because, as you say, in general, what I would have is, well, I mean, this thing would talk to something else that's here, and this to something else that's here, and this to something that's here.
So do you have a way of writing that condition down in the general boundary formulation or the positive version of it?
There are various ways that you could imagine doing that. I mean, one thing is that I haven't really spelled out how to formalize these quantum operations. I've left them very generic, right? So for me, here I'm just assuming there are some maps from this boundary condition space to the complex numbers or to the real numbers, and I haven't said anything more. So one thing you could do, obviously, would be to just engineer this map in such a way that it's insensitive to the physics here, and would, for different quantum boundary conditions, give the same result in some sense. Mm. Another possibility would be to put on here something like the vacuum state. And then no matter what operation you would put here, then you could evaluate that or something. It's not the case that this evaluation is necessarily a probability here, right? Because I haven't really specified what these quantum operations are. I mean, it would more likely be some kind of expectation values, some kind of expectation value. So, I mean, this is really only a kind of first indication how a relation to your formulation could be established. It's still very far from really nailing it down to. So the question mark here should be much bigger.
We should probably stop there. So let's thank Robert.